Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Jansen Brooks, and this is the Council of Elders Call-In Talk Show. Today is Saturday, June 11th, 2022, and we have a great show lined up for you today. We have Malcolm Hughes, a successful real estate investor, who we're going to be sharing information about how to acquire properties and some of the ins and outs and tips of real estate investing. Just as a word start about the Council of Elders concept, it's a simple concept where elders in the community will try to instill wisdom and knowledge to young people, help them navigate through life and avoid some of the pitfalls that can happen to everyone, and also learning from them about their feelings and to share their feelings and their knowledge because they are smart indeed. So with that, let me just share that today we have Malcolm Hughes. Malcolm, welcome to the show today.
Hello, hello, Jansen. Thank you for inviting me.
All right, all right, right. Malcolm, I want to give a shout out to your wife. I understand that you you guys just celebrated 42 years of marriage. Congratulations.
Hey, thank you for that. It's been 42 long, long, I better say wonderful years. But yeah,
all right, all right.
Listen, to any of the married people, they know the ups and downs of being married.
And you say there's two words that can help a man have a good marriage?
Oh, absolutely. What the two words that makes for a successful marriage are, yes, dear, and that'll take you a long way.
So any of you guys out there that's listening in, just remember those two words, yes, dear. All right, all right. Malcolm, let's talk a little bit about your real estate career. About what year did you start your first investment?
No, around 1981, 82, somewhere along those lines. And quite frankly, house I bought, the first house, very first real estate investment I bought, I lost it due to not paying the taxes on it. But that's a whole nother story.
Oh, okay, okay. Now, as far as real estate investors that yourself and that you talk to, what are some of the goals of real estate investing? Is it passive income? Is it just they just like the game? Or just what are some of the goals of real estate investing? Why would a person want to get into buying and selling properties or buying and renting properties?
You hit the nail on the head, Jan, when you said passive income. A lot of people want to replace their 9-to-5 job income. And once they find out that they can purchase homes or purchase real estate, and the income generated from that real estate will replace their 9-to-5 income, or the passive income that is produced from real estate will be in excess of their living expenses, then they think they have a certain amount of financial freedom. So that is one goal. Some people get into it for altruistic reasons. They want to provide homeless shelter to the homeless or something of that nature. They want to help people get a step up off the street. They want to help people go from one level to a level up, so to speak, in their housing situation. So there are a variety of reasons. If I'm being honest, money motivates me, and I just like the idea of generating income.
Right. So how do you suggest that someone could prepare themselves to start acquiring properties, you know, as far as their credit scores or income, down payments and stuff? If someone wanted to start a real estate investment career, what are some of the tips that you would give them?
Well, certainly credit is super important. But it's with anything that any venture that I start, Jan, it always starts with your mindset. Once we go from our mindset, we got to make up our mind, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to make the sacrifices that it takes to be successful doing this. Then it goes to educating ourselves in that particular arena, educating yourself about real estate. I would strongly suggest that you find a mentor. And from the education and the mentorship, you should be able to really prepare yourself into purchasing real estate or whatever endeavor that you want to go into.
I see. So as far as people who are not into it right now and they want to get into it, are there ways that they can improve their credit score, or I guess I'm trying to say prepare themselves so that when the time comes, they can get the financing that they need?
Well, certainly. I mean, hey, you know the old saying, hey, pay your bills on time, and that's going to get your credit score up. You want to I'm no credit expert, and I would certainly advise people to certainly check into credit repair or whatever it takes to get that credit up. But quite frankly, there are ways to back in the old days, this guy used to be on TV advertising. No money, bad credit, you can still get into real estate. And this is certainly possible, but I would not recommend that. I think the better way to do it, one way to do it, let me put it like that, is to have good credit. And then you need a certain amount of money in your pocket in order to generate income. The old adage, it takes money to make money, is somewhat true in real estate, but not always true, because you can always tap into some other sources of funding for your real estate deal. I have purchased property using credit cards. I have purchased property, I can't say I had any family and friends that wanted to invest with me or gave me money to put down on the property, other than my mom. But you can go to family and friends if they know what you're doing and they have faith and confidence in what you're doing. They may want to fund your deal. One of the things that I've also used, I think, to fund my first deal was the HELOC, a home equity line of credit, where I had a certain amount of equity in my home, and I borrowed against that, and I used the money that I borrowed against it to purchase a few investment properties. And, of course, there's always the old traditional, the bank loan. You can go to your bank loan officer, someone that you talk about preparing, you know, regardless of what you do, have a relationship with a banker. And that's hard to do sometimes. I know here in Atlanta it's hard to do sometimes because these bankers rotate from place to place quite frequently. They never around more than a couple of years at most. But in many small towns, that banker would be there. And in the small community banks, those bankers will be there for some time. So get to know them when you go in there. Stop by and speak with your banker. Develop that relationship with the banker. That helps tremendously.
Okay, just let him know or her know that you're interested in getting some properties and you want to use that bank to help you get started and just have a relationship with them, you say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're going to the bank anyway. You're depositing your paycheck in there. You're writing checks from them. You're borrowing money for a car. You're borrowing money for maybe your own home. And so expand that a little bit further into borrowing money to invest in real estate. And so, but the thing is, have that relationship with that banker for whatever reason that might come up. It could not be for not only real estate. You might need money to send your child to college or something. Whatever you might need money for, if you have a relationship with that banker, then it makes the process, it facilitates the process much easier.
Right, right. What criteria, when you're selecting a property, you're looking for, traditionally you look for single family homes. I know you're evolving to other types of investments. But if, when you're looking for a property to purchase, what criteria, what are the things that you look for to say, well, you know, this is a good deal or this is not a good deal?
Well, when you – I'll start out with something has to attract you to that particular property. It could be the location. It could be something that you're familiar with. It could be a place that you might have passed by every day coming home from work. It could be a place that you grew up around, but you develop some kind of connection to that. It's kind of intrinsic, but you develop some kind of connection to that particular property. You got to like the property, but at the end of the day, me personally, I like property that has more than three bedrooms. I thought the four and five bedrooms home were the best, was where I wanted to be. That's not historically three bedrooms, two baths, one car with two car garage are the houses that sell the most and the houses that rent the most. I just preferred four bedroom houses. I preferred houses that needed minor work, you know, what they call put lipstick on a pig, cosmetic work. You could go in and you put paint on the walls and you maybe put some new, back in the day when I first started, you put down new carpet and that was all the repairs that had to be made. And so I would certainly look for a house now that and then start now that didn't take a whole lot of major work. I wasn't knocking out any walls. I wasn't redoing the plumbing, or I had to put in bring an electrician in to rewire the house or something like that. In other words, I did the easy stuff, you know, the minor stuff, the least amount of work that I could get to make that house functional and start cash flowing money. For rental purposes, then that's the approach that I took, and that's what really affected me to the houses.
Oh, okay. So traditionally you have liked, was it four-bedroom houses, three-bedroom houses, you say?
I when starting out, I liked the four-bedroom or five-bedroom house. I bought very few three-bedroom houses. When the four- and five-bedroom houses, when the market kind of dried up and it no longer was a buyer's market, I started pretty much adjusting my criteria and started buying a few more three-bedroom homes. Back when I first started out, for the most part, you know, when I really doubled down on this thing, it was during the real estate bust around 2008-09-10. And so there were a lot of newer homes, and so I would try to buy newer homes. Again, as the market dried up and it was no longer a buyer's market, I started buying older homes. I mean, there's the homes that were built after 2000. I started buying homes as far back as 85, or I've even bought older homes than that.
Oh, okay. Now, do you have, like, property managers, or do you – pretty much do it hands-on as far as getting the contractors and repair people. How do you handle that?
Dan, the experts will tell you to hire a professional property manager. I kind of go against the grain myself a lot of the time. I won't say most of the time. but I have self-managed all of my property. I hire the contractors. I do every. I oversee every aspect of my residential properties. I have. I'm getting a little older now, so I'm trying to transition. I'm involving more of my family members if I can get them interested, getting them involved a little bit more, so they help me do a little bit of property management, teaching them the ropes about stuff. And so, again, the experts say hire a professional property manager. It just didn't make sense to me that I would pay someone to call me to tell me that, hey, we need your approval for this repair when I can oversee that repair myself. As I've grown a little bit and expanded my real estate holdings, I don't necessarily do property management, but I used to go on site for every single repair that I had to do. When you got three or four houses, you can do that. And now it's almost impossible for me to do that. And so I found myself becoming more automated in the sense that I can develop a relationship with trusted contractors. And even in trying out new contractors, I will give them the job. They can. I've learned more about what needs to be done. And so I feel a little bit better now as far as managing property without managing a repair, without putting my eyes on it as far as repairs are concerned. The money part of it, collecting rents and so forth, I've kind of always done that myself. It's never been a problem. I wanted to count my money. I like to see it coming in. That's part of the enjoyment for me, you know, is managing that process at the end of the month. It was a joke I used to tell. We're talking about property management, but I used to say, hey, I put on my bathrobe and go out to my mailbox and look at my rent checks once a month on the first of every month, theoretically. And so now I don't even put a bathrobe on. I go upstairs in my underwear and turn on my computer and see if my money hit the bank. So, but that's self-managing. We're talking about property management.
Right. So as far as your repairmen, handyman, contractors, what do you look for what do you look for in people that's helping you do the work?
Jensen, I think contractors, your handymen, are one of the most critical pieces of the whole situation of real estate investing, you know, especially for residential real estate. And the contractors have been, if I had good contractors from the beginning, or if I had those relationships and had good contractors, I'd be much further along in the game. But you just give people a shot, you know. Referrals is one way I go about getting contractors. I have been through hundreds of contractors, literally, during the last 15, 20 years that I've been doing this. And I'm always looking for new contractors. And for some reason, here lately, the last 3 or 4 years or so, I've been getting pretty good contractors. But those contractors, they get turned over every once in a while. And basically, you want to give somebody, just give them an opportunity to do what they say. If you can get a referral, that's great. I tell you, one of the things that really is a problem for me and will probably cause me not to hire a contractor is when a contractor comes to me and says the job is going to cost them, they can say it's going to cost $500 and I need half of it up front. And I'm going like, well, I will buy the supplies, so you don't need, when you finish your work, you know, you'll get paid. But it's very rare that I'm going to pay a contractor any money up front. We'll sit down and we'll talk. I'm not saying I haven't done it, but when I find out, my experience is that when you pay people money up front, or contractors up front, especially if you're talking thousands of dollars, things don't work out to you to your satisfaction. So one of the things that I do is I always buy all of my products. I send them down to Home Depot, and they do a phone sale. I get immediately, I'm looking at the invoice of things that they purchase. And through trial and error experience, I have learned to read that invoice to see if what they purchase is reasonable. Are they purchasing the additional materials on me or whatever? I had a guy, a long-term contractor, quite frankly, that was putting out some floors for me. And he bought 3 boxes of nails. It was cost about $18 a box. And they were finishing nails. And it was 2,500 nails in each box. And I'm going like, what the heck do you need 7,500 nails for in this little small house? And I mean, I'll check those invoices from Home Depot religiously. I've had people, I'm going like, well, we got to take a, they go to Home Depot. Home Depot has the highest prices on sodas and candy bars and cookies and snacks. And I'll see where they're fetching a $4 a soda pop from Home Depot. And I have to take it off of their check sometimes. But I mean, but these contractors, I mean, they are the key. They can make or break your business. And if you got good contractors, you're in a much, much better shape. The contractors are, I find the contractors are I would hate to say this, but they can be more critical than your tenants. Because most tenants will pay rent if they want to stay there, you know. But those contractors, man, they are a different breed. They really are.
Right, right. Let me just say that if anyone's listening and you have a question or comment for Malcolm, just press the number 1 on your phone, and we'll let you ask a question or make a comment. So, Malcolm, as far as selecting tenants, I know there's Section 8 out there. I know that there's other tenants that you can have, but what is your criteria for selecting a good tenant? What tenant would you accept, and what tenant would you potentially pass up on?
Well, first of all, you want to do a good a background check. And the ideal tenant is going to have household income of 2.5 times to 3 times what the rent is. An ideal is the tenant is going to be two income household, where you have two people in the household that's earning income and they can cover rent. That's a good start. And, of course, you're going to do a background check. I've learned to go and look at court records to see whether there are any evictions in the past. But we had to evolve to this stage. We ran across a saying somewhere in the industry that as far as tenants are concerned, if you pay, you stay. If you don't, you won't. And so when I first started out, that was really the criteria. Hey, if you got the deposit in the first month rent, you can get in the house. And that's one of the biggest mistakes I've made is sometimes people have a deposit in the first month rent. That might be a trouble tenant. You really need to go a little bit deeper and to investigate the background of that tenant before you just accept them with that. But that was starting out, and those are rookie mistakes. And I, quite frankly, the worst tenant that you can come up with is a tenant who got 2 or 3 months rent in advance and who needs to move this weekend. And that is because they are being evicted 9 times out of 10. And so if somebody needs to move immediately, they're desperate to move, that's a red flag. And I hate to say this, but I'll say this about, and please forgive me, people, but I say this about contractors and tenants. When tenants come to you, and I'm blessed myself, you know, I'm a very religious man, I'm a Christian, but when tenants, contractors come to you and start talking about, hey, I'm blessed, and thank you, Jesus, and they start dropping a whole lot of Jesus talk into your conversation, that appears to be a warning sign to me. And I hate to say that because I know, you know, all my blessings come from God. I'm a strong believer in that, and I tithe and so forth. But those tenants can be a little bit troublesome. The tenants who come to you with a lot of Jesus talk, the tenants who come to you need to move immediately, those are warning signs. And we better leave it at that. I don't want to get myself in any trouble talking about bad tenants.
Right, right, right. Well, sometimes back with that, the Jesus talk can just be a front. It could be a cover to you feel sorry for them, or, you know, or make you think that they are, you know, someone who they are not. So,
my point exactly.
It's funny
you
that
are
you...
exactly right.
All right.
I wonder if there are any other landlords out there who've experienced that particular situation.
Oh, okay. Well, if there's anyone that's experienced that, we can talk about that as well. And Malcolm, you have evolved from just only thinking about single family homes, and to nowadays you're more looking towards shopping centers or other types of industrial properties. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know what? Before we get into that, there's one other question I wanted to ask you. You mentioned that the numbers have to work, and we talked about capitalization rate or cap rate. And I know that if anyone's listening, you know, you're not going to get this whole thing in a one-hour show, but it will give you something to research and to find out more about. So, Malcolm, can you give us a little bit of insight on what you mean when you say capitalization rate or return of investments in as far as property investing?
Your cap rate, first of all, you want to establish a cap rate. For me, a cap rate, a preferred cap rate is double digits. And I, at one point in time, I had no problem getting double-digit cap rates. A cap rate is simply your net operating income divided by your purchase price. And vice versa, in order to determine a purchase price, you can divide your net operating income divided by a desired cap rate. If you want a cap rate of 10%, then you divide the net operating your net operating income of $1,000 with the $10,000 annually divided by a purchase price of $100. And you guys, I'm not the best at explaining cap rate and these numbers, although I am a CPA. But go and look these things up for yourself. It's fairly easy. But I determine my net operating income. I look at my gross income, how much I have rents for. I take out my expenses, and that's going to give me my net operating income, okay? And so if I divide that by my purchase price, that's going to give me my cap rate. I like back when I started really getting down into this, delving a little deeper, my cap rate was around, I could get as high as a 35% cap rate. A 35% cap rate gives me my money back in 3 to 5 years, okay? Now, if I can get a 10% cap rate, it's totally, that's desirable now. You'll find a lot of the larger investors or hedge fund investors, they typically look at cap rates of 5%. They're satisfied with that because they have a lot of money that they have to put into play for their investors. And so, but that cap rate is very important. It's one of the most important numbers that that I utilize when I am evaluating the property. I want that cap rate to be about 10%. And with a 10% cap rate, it essentially means I'm going to get all my money back within 10 years, 10 or 11 years, because there are other factors other than the net operating income and the purchase price. You got repairs and maintenance and things of that nature. But you also have rental increase over a 10-year period. So, but a 10% cap rate, which is double digit, works well for me in today's environment. One of the things about cap rate, the higher the cap rate, the more management is. They are typically associated with what I said, lower income properties. Lower cap rates are typically associated with higher price properties. And so you get a property with a lower cap rate, you expect to have market appreciation. In other words, we're talking about residential real estate, you expect that house to appreciate over time. It's going to be in a great neighborhood, and it's going to cost you $200,000 or $300,000 initially. You know, a property that's going to give you 30% cap rate, lots of times would be in a lower price neighborhood. It's going to require a heck of a lot more property management, just simply because the people who can afford those rates, the people who are going to be renting those properties are going to require a little bit more management, and the repairs may be a little higher and so forth. But cap rate is so very important, one of the key indicators that I utilize when I am evaluating whether I really want to purchase this property.
Right, right. How do you market, or if you have a property, how do you let the world know it? Do you put it in the papers, on the internet, or you just have people waiting in line? How do you market, I guess you, I could simply say, your properties?
Real estate is an evolving industry, Jan, so, you know, everything changes. When I first started out, I still have signs in my garage that say a house for rent, called 3-4 bedroom house for rent, called 770-365-7473, Section 8 accepted, you know, something like that. Oh, at one point in time, as many people will know, you got a sign out in the yard to say house for rent. That means they come steal my air conditioner. And so we had to get away from putting those signs out, and then we went on the internet. And so Craigslist is a good one. We have GoSection8.gov is a good one. Most of the time now I put something on GoSection8.gov, and I love Section 8 quite a bit, but we put it on GoSection8.gov, we put it on Craigslist, and that property will be rented within 30 days. In today's environment, especially here in the Atlanta area, it's not hard to market a property. The supply is substantially less than the demand. And so, again, we do it on the internet. We market things on the internet. A lot of things are word of mouth. I literally have a waiting list of people who are calling me almost daily, certainly weekly. Well, Malcolm, do you have a house rent? Well, Malcolm, did anybody move out of that house yet? And so word of mouth is also another good one. When people know what you're doing, it's the law of attraction. You know, if people know you're a mechanic, they're going to start calling. You're going to start getting calls about, hey, will you fix my car? Will you take a look at my car? If they know you're a contractor, they know that, hey, you're going to get calls saying, hey, can you come take a look at this because of referral? And again, I have people calling me constantly about renting my houses. We won't even talk about the people trying to buy them. And that's a whole nother subject matter. But that word of mouth is very important. People, relatives, hey, my daughter's ready to rent her house. My cousin want to rent a house. Or, you know, my nephew or family relatives or my girlfriend wants to rent a house, and I had your number. And these could be current tenants. These could be prior tenants, people who moved on to moving on from my house or whatever. But, you know, having a good reputation in the business is the best marketing plan that you can have. Obviously, the internet is the way to go these days. I don't have a website. I do need to develop one. I don't really talk a whole lot about houses on my Facebook page, which is obviously another way to market houses. I talked about people talking about they're blessed, but I'm really truly blessed, and I was a CPA. Well, I am a CPA since 1980 something, and I've never even had my phone number published in the phone book when you used to have phone books. And so things just have come to me, you know, and to me that's a blessing in itself. But they just come to me. It was organically, you could say, but it's the law of attraction. You know, if you do a good job, things will come to you. And so that marketing is key in so many businesses, and I wouldn't advise anybody to do it the way that I've done it. Because I've made a lot of mistakes and I've succeeded in spite of my mistakes. And so, you know, for that's the reason for that. But marketing is the key. Again, internet marketing is where you want to be.
Okay, so realistically, in the Atlanta area right now, people that have houses for rent, they don't really have too much of a problem getting renters. I guess the main deal would be getting the right renters, though, rather than just getting, like you say, what was that mantra you had, Malcolm? If you pay, you can stay, or something like that.
If you don't, you won't. But you're exactly right about that. I mean, people are clamoring for houses. It's just like supply and demand. It's a law of supply and demand right here in Atlanta right now. and the people are coming here to Atlanta almost every day. It's where you can, if you purchase property, that's one of the reasons I want to level up to multifamily properties, is because I think you can be very successful with multifamily properties. And one of the reasons I'm somewhat successful is because I purchased property during the Great Depression. And that's 2008, 19, you know, during that time era. And so the properties that I purchased were at substantially lower prices than they are right now.
Right, right. Now, we were talking before the show, and you said that there is a new concept in the real estate investing community about getting a fourplex first and kind of leveling up. Can you kind of highlight that a little bit, Malcolm?
Sure. I have for years, for the last 30 years, 40, 30 something, over 30 years, I've advised people, hey, purchase a home. That's the first thing that you need to do. You need to stop renting. And you need, and I am in the business of renting homes, but you know, I advise people, and I try to help people who rent my homes to purchase a home of your own. You know, that's the best route that you can take. It's what I always thought. Now I have recently, within the last 2-3 years, I have been listening to a lot of these podcasts, and I saw an idea that was somewhat new to me, and it made all the sense in the world, and that's the 4-3-2-1. And it revolves around an FHA loan. And you guys need to, if you're interested in doing this, you got to do your research. You got to educate yourself. But anyway, the concept is if I'm in the mindset here is that I'm not trying to buy one home. I'm trying to buy at least two homes, at least two real properties. And ideally, it'll be four properties or 10 properties over a period of time. But the concept of the 4-3-2-1 is I buy a fourplex. That is a small apartment unit that has four units in it. This requires sacrifices. But I live in one unit, and I rent out the other three units. Well, what happens is I can get a loan because I owner-occupy the property. My loan is going to be 3.5%. Okay, another thing that's going to qualify me for the property is the fact that the property is going to produce rental income. And the rental income plus my salary is going to allow me to get a loan for qualify for a larger loan amount, okay? But remember, we're not just buying one house. This is just the first house, okay? This is not our dream house, so to speak. This is our first house. And so what we want to do is we want to get our foot in the door. But we buy the first property, which is a fourplex. We live in one unit, and we rent out the other three units. Those units produce rental income for us. Okay, with the FHA loan, you have to live in the property at least a year, and don't get slick and think you're going to rent out all four units and live somewhere else. I wouldn't advise that, is what the experts say. But once you live in that house for a year, you refinance it with a conventional loan, and then you buy a triplex. That's a house with an apartment with three units to it. Okay, you live in one unit, and you have two other units paying your rent. So now what you have the fourplex where you just moved out of, and you got four people paying your rent. Then you buy a triplex where you got two other people paying your rent, and you're living in this home for at least 1 year. That's six pieces of rental income right there, okay? And so, and then you go down, do that for a year, and then that's going to qualify you for a duplex. And that's where you live on one side and you rent the other side out. By the time you do this, it's a patience game. You know, it's a long game. Real estate is not a get-rich-quick scheme. You don't get rich overnight. You know, you don't turn this or flip this and make, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, in a year or two or three. You know, it's a long game. You know, this takes a little bit of time. But you buy that duplex, and now you got all these units that are paying you rent. You're living in one. After you do this, you are pretty much ready for your dream home now. After about 7 to 10 years, you might be ready for your dream home at that point in time. Now we use the word passive income. Now we got about, 6, 8, 9 units that are paying us rent passive income. That passive income could possibly pay for your dream house and you don't have, you're not paying anything. You have acquired those units and rented them out. You can now afford to buy your dream home with the income that you're generating from these other properties. And the properties that you purchased 10 years ago, that fourplex, it probably has tripled in value. So you got the appreciation, you got the rental income, and now you can actually borrow money against that equity in that fourplex or that triplex or that duplex. You can probably borrow money against that and do whatever it is that you needed to do as far as acquiring other investment properties after you acquired that dream home of yours. So now you started out, instead of buying your first home, and then it started with the duplex, triplex, and the fourplex. You started with the fourplex, sacrifice a little bit, maybe live in an area that maybe you didn't really, it wasn't ideal for you or whatever, but you got to sacrifice if you're going to get ahead in this world, is what I found. Nothing is easy. And so it's the 4-3-2-1 principle. So that's what I would advise young people to do at today's time. It makes sense to me, you know.
Okay. That is one of the newer strategies for purchasing real estate, the 4-3-2-1 strategy.
Correct.
Okay. Go ahead, Malcolm.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Okay, so let's talk about deal syndication, which is something that you are looking at now for purchasing larger properties, shopping centers, malls or whatever, industrial buildings and so forth. Let's talk about a little bit about deal syndication. Can you highlight a little bit on that?
Well, I just got through talking about doing four deals with smaller residential type property, one commercial real estate, and the things that you mentioned, industrial, multifamily, i.e. apartments or self-storage or whatever, one big deal could actually let you bypass a whole lot of those steps. In my situation, I think that you grow into things, and by me doing the smaller homes, single-family homes first, then I can elevate up into larger homes, commercial real estate. And I'm at a level right now where I want to do commercial real estate. And so in order to do commercial real estate, one of the strategies, there are many, one of the strategies that I like that I run across is called syndication, i.e. I am the syndicator. And let's just take an example. Let's say, Jan, you and I, we talked, and I told you about a property over in the Starkville, Mississippi, real close to Mississippi State University that I was interested in. So let's say you and I decided, because it's close to an area we're familiar with, let's say you and I decided to that we wanted to syndicate that deal. Well, you and I would be a general partner on that. And we would divide up our responsibilities. You might have responsibility for finding other investors in that deal. But what we would do is we would package the deal together. We would figure out what it's going to take. We would get the attorneys that we needed. We would do the due diligence that would be needed to acquire the property. We would determine the environmental analysis studies that are going to be required on the property. We would meet with the banks. We would meet with the other investors or whatever. But we would be the general partners. Now, what we would do is we would go out and find us limited partners. And let's say the deal cost $1 million, okay? And we needed to come up with $250,000 down that would be the down payment that you have on. We don't have to come up with $1 million ourselves. But if we wanted to go to a bank to get that property financed, the bank is not going to give us $1 million. The bank is going to say, I want you guys to have some skin in the game. And so we got to come up with $250,000 because the bank said, I'm going to finance 75% of that deal, which is $750,000. You and I have to come up with $250,000. So what we would do is we would get on the phone and we would call business associates or whatever and say, hey, who wants to invest $50,000 into this particular syndication? Or who wants to invest $25,000? Until we came up with the $250,000. And quite frankly, because you and I did the due diligence and all the legwork, and we did all the background work that was required on the property, we may put a minimum amount in, but we would put in what you would call sweat equity. And we would depend on our limited partners to come up with the majority of the $250,000 of down payment that would be required from the bank in order to finance the property. And that, i.e., is a syndication. We have a general partner, which would be you and I, who would do all the due diligence and background work. We would have limited partners who would come up with the $250,000 that would be required to fund the property, and we would have the bank that's going to come up with the $750,000 to get us up to $1 million. Then as general partners, it is your responsibility and my responsibility to manage. We would get professional managers on this property. We may try to do it ourselves. I have done it before, manage a property myself. But we would more than likely, we would hire a professional property management company. But it would be our job, you and I, to manage that asset manager. And so that property management company that we hired. And so we would have to make sure that they are doing their job, that they kept the property leased up, that they maintain the property, make sure that, you know, there was nothing nefarious going on, drug dealing or trash in the yard or keeping the parking lots and all that kind of stuff, making sure that the property maintains its value is what our job would be to, as asset managers, to manage the property managers. And so in simplest terms, that is just a fancy name for a different type of partnership, a limited partnership agreement.
That's pretty clear. I would imagine that at some point you would probably need a lawyer or someone to draw up the paperwork so that everybody is on point and knows what's going on.
Absolutely, and that's our job as the general manager. That would be our job to hire the attorneys, to put a marketing plan together that you talked about, a marketing plan that's going to convince these investors that, hey, this is a good investment and you are going to get a return on your investment. That marketing plan is going to explain to the investors, hey, what we're going to do is you're going to get a return on your investment for it's not going to be quick, say from 5 to 7 years. And at the end of the 5 to 7 years, you talk about an exit strategy. Our strategy would be that, hey, we're going to go out, and we talked about appreciation before. We're going to go out, and we're going to refinance this property, and we're going to pay you all of your money back. And between 5, 7, 10 years, you will have received annual income from the property, and you will get all your money back that you invested in the property at the end of whatever time period that we designated, if we could achieve the goals that we set out initially. And so you got it. The person who invested the $50,000 at the end of 10 years, they may have, you know, an investment now that's worth $250,000, as an example. And so the deal has to be attractive, and your investment partners, your limited partners, you want to make sure that they are taken care of in the deal, and that all comes from the property asset management of the property.
Right. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Malcolm Hughes today, real estate investor. If you have a question or comment, we got another 10 minutes or so. If you have a question or comment, press the number 1 on your phone, and you can ask a question or make a comment. Malcolm, you are a member of one or more real estate investment clubs. Can you tell us about the local real estate investing clubs and what are some of their uses to someone that wants to learn more about how to get into real estate investing?
Jensen, I think that those real estate investment clubs are one of the key factors that's going to make you a successful realtor. At those real estate, one of the biggest things is that you are meeting with a group of like-minded people. And these people are going to be very receptive to sharing information, sharing knowledge, sharing good contractors' information, sharing bad contractor information, sharing deals that are out there that are available. This is the lab, I put it like this. This is where you go to make things happen. And you go to experiment, bounce ideas off of other investors. When I started out, I was dealing with residential real estate. I'm getting more into commercial real estate investment clubs. And so this is where you can go, like I said, to find like-minded individuals who are trying to do the same thing that you do. And it's a nurturing environment, if I could use that word. It's not a cutthroat environment. It's not a competitive environment. Is we all there? What I get is that we're all there for the same reason, and we're trying to help each other grow. We're not trying to. It's a little bit of competition, obviously, but you here in Atlanta, you know, it's so much. The area is so large that you don't really bump heads a lot of times. I rarely bump heads with any people that I see in a real estate investment club. And sometimes if I have a deal, if we just talked about syndication, well, if I have a great deal, who do you think I'm going to present my marketing package for to in order to acquire other like-minded investors in this business? And when these people, they're going to scrutinize this deal, they're going to do due diligence on the deal, they're going to come back to me with questions, and sometimes they're going to come back to me with questions of that I haven't thought of. I got to go back and research that to make my package even better, or to tighten up my deal to make sure that I don't lose money on my deal. And so this is the place that you want to be for knowledge, for mentorship. This is one of the best resources that you can have is going to be the Real Estate Investment Club. And again, I don't care where you're at, if you're in rural Mississippi or you're in New York City, you can Google real estate investment clubs, and I'm sure you will find one that's going to be within an hour of where you live right now. Like I say, you can be in rural Mississippi, rural Alabama, and you will find a real estate investment club that you can drive to within an hour. And like many other things with COVID, a lot of these are Zoom conferences or Zoom meetings now. And so, you know, we get up and we go into a Zoom meeting and we still are able to discuss these ideas. And quite frankly, Zoom is one of the best things personally that I've seen lately. You know, it saves a lot of time and effort as far as travel, getting ready to go someplace and coming back and forth like that. Now you can meet on Zoom, and that takes care of it. And since I brought Zoom up, one of the things that Zoom also does is it helps you look at a property from a distance that you don't have to actually go to that property. You can have a real estate agent or a business partner meet you there, and they Zoom the meeting in. This is what technology allows us to do. But those real estate investment clubs is, again, one of the best resources that you're gonna encounter in this real estate venture.
And you say that there are residential real estate investment clubs, and also there are commercial and industrial real estate investment clubs.
Absolutely. Well, the ones that I'm a part of, you know, we discuss all kind of commercial real estate. Could be an industrial park, could be an apartment complex, multifamily apartment complex. It could be a self-storage unit. It could be a what else is out there? You know, it could be a truck parking spot. You know, so whatever is commercial, it could be a retail shopping center, could be an office building. So these are the ones that things that we discuss at the commercial real estate investment groups. The residential, of course, we talk houses, contractors, and so forth.
Right. So anyone's listening, if you want to learn more about getting into real estate, Malcolm is suggesting that you Google real estate investment clubs in your area, and he says that there's you're never more than probably an hour away from a real estate investment club, and there are single family type real estate investing clubs, and there are multifamily and commercial and industrial real estate investment clubs. We got about 5 minutes. If anyone has a quick comment, press number one on your phone, and we can do that. I see someone in the 916 area code here. Let's see. Okay, caller 3747, please state your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Ron Gilmore here in Sacramento. Hope all is well. I'm enjoying what I'm hearing, and I wanted to ask you, Malcolm, how does one do their due diligence on the real estate investing club first? And secondarily, is the club actually, and I'm sorry I joined in later, is the club actually individuals that are investing together on properties, or is it like a support group? And I'll take my answer on the phone here. Thank you.
It is, thanks, Ron. It is a support group, more so than anything. But within this support group, those relationships will develop, and you will probably invest. You may find an investment partner. That's going to be the real estate investment club is going to be one of the best places you can go to find an investment partner.
Okay, thank you. And the other was, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ron. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, thank you. The other part of the question was due diligence. Well, I guess it wouldn't matter because it's a group and not necessarily a investment or individuals investing together in the group. It's more of a support. So you did answer that. Thank you. I certainly appreciate it and enjoying.
Right, and it's like you're saying, Ron, you're going to go to that club. It's just like any other group that you go to. If you're in a if you go to church, you're going to develop a certain relationship with people in church, and you're going to get a feel for whether you can trust them. If you are in a sorority or fraternity, it's going to be certain brothers and sisters that you're going to want to do business with and certain ones that you're not going to do business with. You know, whatever group meeting that you go to, you're going to find someone, you can possibly find someone that, hey, this person sounds like they are knowledgeable, they have integrity, they have character, they're the type of person I want to do business with. And there's going to be some in that group that you're going to say, hey, they're kind of shady. I'm not sure if I want to do business with them. So you're going to have to make that evaluation yourself. Gee, and I want to say one thing before time runs out on us, before your next question, if I could. People, I've been looking at interest rates on savings accounts. And as most of you know, they have reached up to 1% or 1.75% here, but you can hardly get a good savings rate. When I was a kid, 5%, I had a 5% savings account. Matter of fact, we bought savings bonds when I was a kid in elementary and high school. But you guys research this. It's called an I-bond, and it's issued by the United States Treasury, just like those savings bonds that we used to buy as kids. But this I bond, the letter I, is paying over 9% interest rate. I thought this was the greatest thing I've heard in the last 10 years as far as interest rates were concerned. So I would suggest that everybody go out and investigate this and educate yourself on I bonds. You can, like I say, the Treasury, United States Treasury, if you got faith and confidence in them, I'm not going to comment on that, but investigate an I-bond. The maximum amount you can put in one is $10,000, but I think it's one of the greatest investment vehicles that we have out here today. And it's fairly safe if you believe in your federal government.
Right, right. You say it's paying how much?
Over 9%. Over 9%.
Oh, okay.
Google it.
Okay. Well, we've got about a minute and a half, Malcolm. We certainly learned a lot today. You've been very informative on your talks about real estate investing, and you are the type of person that people can listen to because you've been there and done that, and you have the experience. A lot of times you can listen to your Uncle Joe or somebody who never done it. And you can get one result, or you can listen to someone that's done it. So thank you for coming on the show today. Everybody, thank you for listening today. If you want to listen to this again, you can go to blogtalkradio.com, and then in the search bar, just type in the Council of Elders, call-in talk show, or just the Council of Elders. And in a few hours, you can listen to this show again if you came in late. It was a very good, informative show today. So with that, I'm going to say goodbye to everybody. And Malcolm, thanks again for joining us today, and congratulations on the 42 years of holy matrimony. All right, everybody. God
hey, thanks
willing,
a lot, Jan.
Talk to you next week.
Good night.
All right.
Okay, let's see.